I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Nandan Nilekani, co-founder of Infosys, a global information technology and consulting company. Nandan started Infosys in Bangalore, India, with six colleagues in 1981, and the company has more than 150,000 employees and $7 billion in revenue. Nandan left Infosys in 2009 and is leading a social initiative started by the Indian government. He is the chair of the Unique Identification Authority of India, which through its project Aadhaar is seeking to provide unique identifications to every Indian resident. This biometric ID system will revolutionize distribution of social benefits and financial services. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica. Thank you for having me.
Aadhaar is essentially building a pipeline through which services will get delivered in a cost-effective way.
Yes, Aadhaar is actually a platform, and the word Aadhaar means foundation. So it's a foundational platform which enables everyone to have a unique identity number, which acts as a proof of identity and a proof of address. And on that foundation, you can build a variety of services and benefits for the common man.
It will be the largest database in the world. How many people are you focused on reaching eventually?
Well, eventually the idea is to reach every resident of India, which is over a billion people. But it's already the world's largest biometric database. And it's also multimodal, which means that it looks at both the iris of both the eyes and the fingerprints and a photograph. And the reason we need the biometrics is essentially to establish uniqueness of identity.
And I know that it's just the pipeline, but you obviously now can think hard about your whole welfare system in India. You're enabling that.
Yeah. We think that on this platform, a large number of applications will get built.
Right.
Now, reforming the welfare system is just one application of this platform, which in some sense is the original driver and which essentially pays for the cost of building this. But once this platform is rolled out, we see a lot many applications coming, some of which we can't even visualize today. An example of that in the US would be the GPS, the Global Positioning System. If you recollect, the GPS was designed by the military for military purposes, for precision bombing and all that. But in the year 2000, the GPS was put in the commercial domain. And since then, there's been a huge industry around the GPS.
Mm-hmm.
And all the GPS does is answer the question, where am I? And on top of that, all these applications have come about.
Okay.
Now, in the year 2000, when GPS was put in the commercial domain, you could not have visualized that 10 years later, you would be sitting in your car and using your smartphone and, you know, finding out how to go home. So I think we also see this, we can see lots and lots of applications that we can't even comprehend today, which we think will bring immeasurable benefits to our people.
Fingerprints are obviously not without their flaws, especially in places like India where, you know, people work a lot with their hands and the fingerprints are sometimes worn down. How do you deal with those?
That's exactly why we selected both the iris and the fingerprints, because we said if you go with fingerprints alone, then that could perhaps not work out for people who do a lot of manual labor or whose fingers have got eroded. So the iris and fingerprint actually to make it much more inclusive so that everybody gets into the system and gets a unique ID.
In the United States, when a child is born, that's when their ID gets established. Are you now starting to issue IDs to infants when they're born?
Well, the thing is that this is a voluntary number. And it's only a number. It's a digital ID. So, yes, infants also can enroll into the system whenever the parents want to enroll them. And also, one of the reasons we are doing this is because in India, there are a large number of children who don't have birth documents or don't have any piece of paper which identifies who they are.
Can you describe the current system of identification in India?
There are a number of IDs, like elsewhere. You have passports, you have driver's licenses, you have a voter ID card, you have a ration card, which is your entitlement for food subsidies. There's a PAN card for taxpayers. What we were looking for was, one, a universal ID, because we wanted everyone to have the ID, because in many of these IDs, not everyone is covered for a variety of reasons.
Obviously, this initiative is very complicated logistically. Can you walk me through the process for a farmer in the Punjab who has no address, who's 72 years old? How does he typically find out about the program?
Well, we do several media campaigns and radio and television campaigns about Aadhaar, but the biggest information is actually coming from word of mouth, from the buzz around it. because people see this as a gateway to future services. What happens is that we have enrollment stations around the country.
How many?
We have today about 25,000 of them. So people come in and they provide very basic information, name, address, date of birth, sex, email ID and phone number if they have it, and the biometrics. And then all this information is sent to our central processor, which does this deduplication to make sure that everybody gets only one number.
It takes about 15 to 30 minutes per resident.
That's right.
To process.
Actually,
this.
Sometimes even less, maybe 10 to 20 minutes, yeah.
It sounds so smooth, 30,000 feet as we talk here in the studio. But can you talk me through, you know, just some of the, at a granular level, some of the challenges?
No, I think obviously at a high level, it does sound simple. It's actually quite difficult to do because at the enrollment station, we have built a very sophisticated software called the client, enrollment client, that operates in all Indian languages. So when you enroll, for example, if you enroll in Delhi, it'll be in English and Hindi. Mm-hmm. But if you enroll in Karnataka, it'll be English and Kannada. And, you know, every Indian language is there in our system. So it transliterates between English and the local language. So we deal with all this multilingual stuff. Then on the biometric side, we have to allow people to make sure it's high quality biometrics. So we have to build in all those things. So when we rolled this out in September 2010, it was still early days. But based on field experience, we have made the software better and better. And then from these 25,000 locations, all these packets have to be encrypted and physically sent either through a broadband connection or through a hard disk to our data center. So it's a massive data management issue because you have to keep track of each and everyone's details.
What about electricity going out in some of these areas?
Sure. So these people typically have a generator or something when they set up these. If there's no electricity, then they have a small generator which generates electricity while they're doing this task.
How many companies have you partnered with to do this? I mean, obviously, you're not building the biometric iris scanning yourself.
Our partners include state governments, banks, oil companies. That's one side of it. On the technology side, we have about 75 or more enrolling agencies. We have training agencies. We have device suppliers who provide those devices. And we have three biometric deduplication agencies that deduplicate the biometrics which we provide to them.
When you say deduplicate?
Well, you know, let's say 1 million people enroll, and some people enroll, and suppose they enroll more than one time, which is a possibility. How do we make sure that they get only one number? And to do that, we have to compare the biometrics of every enrollee against all the people that we have. And that's a very, very computationally intensive task, because let's say we have 400 million people in our database and 1 million new people enroll that day. Each of the million has to be compared against all 400 million to see whether the person exists or not, and on all attributes. So it leads to trillions of comparisons. So we have a massive computing infrastructure for that. It's something like how the internet companies in the U.S. have, you know, massive data centers. That's the heart of it. We make sure that you get only one number.
Still, Nandan, it's striking how quickly you've been able to get this up and running. Are you worried that the pace will compromise the getting it right part?
No, I don't think so. I don't think speed and accuracy are like opposite. You can combine speed with quality. It really comes down to how well you design and architect what you're doing. There are a couple of reasons why we're able to get this this speed and scale. One is that we didn't try to do everything ourselves. Our core team is less than 300 people, but our ecosystem has maybe 100,000 people. And by creating partnerships, we're able to scale it up very rapidly. The second is that we used big data to manage this whole thing. And also, we kept the design very simple, you know, because I think if you want to do something quickly, you have to have simplicity and minimalism in the design.
We talk about Aadhaar moving at such a quick pace. The speed of change, whether it's in wealth creation or technology in India, has also been accelerated. Can you talk to me about that dynamic?
Oh, absolutely. I think in my own lifetime, you know, so many things have changed. I mean, I really hadn't watched TV till I was 17 years old, and then, you know, we didn't have mobile phones till just 15 years back. We didn't have PCs, we didn't have computers, we didn't have smartphones. And this has coincided with the India's economic liberalization. And I think the mass movement of communications, television, and internet and all that has awakened people to the possibility of what is possible in their lives. So certainly you, in India and elsewhere in the world, you have this huge upsurge of aspirations that are emerging in the global sort of middle class and aspiring classes.
What is an analogous phenomenon in history to this? Some people say the printing press.
Yeah, so certainly the printing press, the democratization of printing, you know, people taking the Bible from elites to common languages. But I don't think we have seen something where there's this scale, we're running into billions of people, this speed of change, this upsurge of aspiration, which is why it's very difficult for societies to deal with this, because the governance system is not able to keep pace with this rapidly changing environment.
The architecture of Aadhaar is open source, which allows others to contribute and build onto the platform. You are in the midst of building the pipe. Simultaneous with that, have you started delivering services through
that? Oh, absolutely. In fact, the first major service we are rolling out is direct benefit transfer, where we are able to attach to ID a bank account. And then once you attach the account to the ID, then I can just send money to the number. So electronic benefit transfer is the first use of this ID for financial transactions.
Obviously, there's going to be errors in the system. In general, how much margin of error do you expect in the system? I've heard numbers from 1 to 4%.
Well, you know, obviously we have the challenge of some people enrolling more than once, where the deduplication takes care of that.
But not always, perhaps.
No, well, we have 99.99% accuracy.
Really?
Yeah. And that's, we have done enough tests for that, which means basically on a billion people, we'll have 100,000 duplicates.
I've heard that it's from like 1 to 4%.
In terms of deduplication, mm-hmm. which is making sure everybody has a unique number,
that's
99.99%. Authentication, where you come and authenticate yourself online, there you may have, you know, 1 or 2%, depending on which part of the system we're talking about. But the way to look at it is not to say that, you know, how perfect it is. It is, where are we starting from? And, you know, today we have a situation where, you know, millions of people don't have an ID and government benefits don't reach the right people. So when you take it from there, it's a huge improvement.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nandan Nilekani, co-founder of Infosys. We'll hear more from Nandan coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Nandan Nilekani, co-founder of Infosys, a global information technology and consulting company. Nandan started Infosys in Bangalore, India, with six colleagues in 1981, and the company has more than 150,000 employees and $7 billion in revenue. Nandan left Infosys in 2009 and is leading a social initiative started by the Indian government. He is the chair of the Unique Identification Authority of India, which through its project Aadhaar is seeking to provide unique identifications to every Indian resident. There are $250 billion that will be spent over 5 years on programs aimed at the poor issued by the Indian government, food, fertilizer, fuel, and 40% of these benefits will go to the wrong people, and Aadhaar is one way to try to address that issue. What has been harder for you personally in this initiative?
Well, I think, you know, and I think this is something that applies to anyone who moves from the private sector to the public sector, anywhere in the world, is that they are very different worlds, right? In the private sector, the goals are clear. You increase revenues, reduce costs, increase margins, increase market cap, increase market share, launch new products, all that stuff. In the public sector, it's there are a lot more stakeholders. There's the government, there's parliament, there's the bureaucracy, there's the journalists, there's activists, there's the judicial system, there's all kinds of oversight bodies. In fact, I had to sort of be the ambassador of that, the project in some sense. So when this project began, I went and met every state government. I met all the banks. I met all the oil companies. met everybody, actually, anybody who had a connection to this. And so by reach and I met all the business groups and all that. The idea was to tell them this is coming, this is what we are planning, and this is how it's going to work. So that when it actually came, nobody was particularly surprised. When you're trying to bring change at scale, you're bound to have many opponents to that change. And that's why by working with all these tech companies, the banks, the state governments, the oil companies, we have tried to create a positive coalition that wants this to happen. And that countervails against the negative coalition.
There has been some opposition to the project, including interests that say that having this vast database held by the government might violate privacy. What is your answer to them?
Well, you know, I think this is unlike a database which collects all kinds of information about you. This is really just an identity database, and the information that's in the system is very simple. Just the name, address, date of birth, sex, and the biometrics. And it's only used for verification or for authorizing your identity to somebody else. And information about you is not kept with this system. It's kept in the respective database. For example, when a bank uses the ID system, the bank has your financial information. Mm. When the healthcare system uses the ID system, the healthcare system has the healthcare records. So by design, it's not to aggregate information, it's rather just user ID. So we have paid a lot of attention to making it as simple as possible and not to create something which will impinge like that on your privacy.
You also, in addition to helping now to transform this social landscape, you helped to pioneer the technology landscape in India in 1981 when you started Infosys with six colleagues. How old were you?
I was 26.
You were 26 years old, and you had worked at Putney Computer Systems in Mumbai, and you decided to venture out and start your own technology service company. What was your vision for the company at that point when you were seven of you?
Well, it was really to create a global company, a company which had an international footprint, a company that was well-respected because it stood for certain values, the ethical conduct, corporate governance, quality, and all that.
You had a global outlook from the inception?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, at no point has the global revenue of the company been below something like 80-90%. It had always had a very international, very global outlook.
Had you been out of India?
Yes. Most of us, the founders, had worked out, traveled abroad, so they were familiar with global business requirements.
You had been abroad?
Yes. I'd worked on projects in Boston. I think I'd just done in Boston.
Talk to me about the level of technology education in India in the 1970s. Like, why were you Indian citizens going to Boston to help them? What was the catalyst for focusing on this?
It's a great point. First of all, you know, you're talking about the late 1970s. The late 1970s were a very interesting time because technology till then were dominated by mainframe computers. You know, IBM 360 and all that. And then the late 70s saw the rise of mini computers. So you had all these exciting new companies from the Boston area, called the Route 128 companies. And by 81, the PC revolution started. So there was a transition from mainframes to mini computers, PCs, and all that happening at that time. And in India in particular, what happened was in 1977, IBM withdrew from the Indian business scene because they had some difference of opinion with the then government. So the market had a sort of a vacuum, and these mini computer companies came and sort of started doing well. And most of us had degrees in engineering from colleges that had taught computers. So there was a large pool of talent. English was the language of business, so people were comfortable operating in a global business environment. So all these things came together.
In the 1970s, the Indian government was more socialist and had specific mandates on companies like Coca-Cola and IBM.
The government of that period insisted that some companies dilute their equity in India. So I think companies like IBM and Coca-Cola decided that those terms were not what they wanted. They decided not to continue to do business there.
Now, you grew up in a family that had socialist leanings. Mm-hmm. Your father was a Fabian socialist. What exactly is a Fabian socialist?
You know, the Fabian socialism was something which came out of the UK in the 1930s and 40s. Essentially, it was a left-leaning philosophy. India's leaders at that time, like Jawaharlal Nehru, all of them were educated in the UK.
Nehru, the
Indian. Well, and who were the first Prime Minister of India. Right. So the government which came into power had socialistic leanings, and that continued till 1991, when the government, they did something called liberalization. They opened up the economy and made it more easier to do business. So when we started Infos, which was a full 10 years before 1991, we were still in sort of the last decade of an environment where business had more challenges.
Given that you had socialist leanings in your family and here you were starting a global company, what were your parents' opinions of what you were doing?
Well, one thing was that it was not generally considered the cool thing to be an entrepreneur in those days. So, you know, people of my generation and my background would seek a job. So the first big thing was my parents' misgivings were about starting a company. And so they had to be convinced about that. But later on, once they saw the success, they were on board.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nandan Nilekani, co-founder of Infosys and the chair of the Unique Identification Authority of India, which through its project Aadhaar is seeking to provide unique identifications to every Indian resident. So talking about the early days of Infosys, talk to me about some of the granular challenges that you faced in Bangalore when you were getting the office together. And
well, everything was a challenge. I mean, you know, getting a phone connection took 2 years in those days. Going abroad required you to take permission from the central bank. And every time you went abroad, you had to go back to them and give a reason why you were going abroad. And they would give you a few dollars because at that time, the Indian economy was very short of foreign currency. So it was very difficult to go abroad to conduct business. And, you know, renting a place would be difficult. It's just that the operative conditions for doing business were very challenging.
You've said before you started the company with $250. What does that mean? Where did that go? And who did it come from?
The $250 was the initial equity capital of the company. You know, the basic shareholding of the company. And then over time, what happened was we were profitable from year one, and we would put our profits back into the company, and that's how we grew the equity of the company.
Now, your wife invested her supposed life savings into the company. What is that story?
Well, she put in a little amount of money, and now it's worth a lot of money. So I guess that's the story. So she's independently wealthy in her own right. That's why she does so much of philanthropy.
I think she invested $180 for about 1.5% of the company, which for a company of $33 billion market cap, roughly, it's not so bad.
Yeah.
What did you do specifically at Infosys in the early days?
I was a project manager, and also I used to assist our partner in selling.
What were some of the important first clients that you had?
Well, our first client was a company, in fact, in New York called Databases Corporation. And the founder and chairman, Mr. Don Lyles, was a very far-sighted gentleman who saw what was happening in the industry. And we became his partners. Through him, we worked on various apparel projects.
Apparel projects?
Yeah, because his company had developed a package for the apparel industry. And we would be his partners in implementing the package at various clients.
Who were some of the other clients that really helped to create a pivot point for you?
Well, one very good client for us was Reebok, which was the shoe company in Boston and also in Europe. And the other was GE. This was in the time of Jack Welch. And they came to India and started sourcing software from Indian companies. And we were fortunate to be one of the first few to work with them. So they also acted as a big catalyst to growing the business. And then in 1993, we went public, raised money, and then we really invested in marketing and sales and opened offices all over the world.
Was it coincidence that you went public after 1991 when India opened up more?
Oh, I think it's a very, it's not a coincidence. I think 1991, the India's economy was liberalized. And they reduced tariffs, they reduced taxes, they made it easier to conduct business, and they made it easier to raise money in the foreign market, in the capital markets, and they brought in foreign investors into the Indian markets, and I think Infosys was able to take advantage of that.
When we hear about Infosys as providing information technology services and consulting, like walk me through an example.
Basically what happens is that companies spend a huge amount of their dollars on their technology to support their operations. For example, they need software to manage their manufacturing, their sales, their marketing, their finance, their supply chain, their sales force. And companies spend billions of dollars and maybe 1 to 5% of their business, of their top line on IT. And they employ a large number of people to do that. And often it's not just about having their own people. They need to outsource this or give this, you know, get other companies who have the expertise to do this. So Infosys provided that that capability.
I've read that you pioneered the global delivery model. What does that mean?
Well, you know, suppose you're making a movie and you're making an animation movie. You know, the movie may be conceived in Hollywood. The producer may be in the East Coast. The animation studio may be in Bangalore. So they all bring all these pieces together and make a movie. So this is sort of globalization of work. And that's what global delivery model does. It explains how you can take an activity, break it up into different pieces, and get them done in different parts of the world, and then you bring it all together again.
In addition to being innovative on the technical on the technology front, Infosys was also innovative on the more social front. It was the first company, for example, to give employees stock options.
Yes.
So there was this governance component to it. Can you talk some more about that?
Infosys was also a pioneer in corporate governance, you know, in running a company ethically, in being very transparent about all its dealings, in putting information about its performance out on the website and to shareholders. So it was not just about technology. It was about creating a new kind of a company, which was very professional and very ethically correct in its behavior.
We might take that for granted in the United States, where laws are formalized. Things are were a little more amorphous at the time.
Yes, basically what happened was that post-1991, when the Indian business environment became much more easier for business to compete, it was also a period when India was setting the structure of the market economy. You know, it was setting up new stock exchanges, new stock regulators, creating electronic shareholding systems and so forth. And in that, I think the role that Infosys played was demonstrate how a company should be run in this modern market economy.
What do you like to do personally?
Actually, I'm very boring because I work or I vegetate. So it's not very impressive.
You vegetate, you don't meditate.
I don't meditate, but I'm quite chilled out. You know? I guess I'm a natural meditator.
Have you always been?
Yes, I don't get hassled too easily. It's a gift. So that helps me because even though there is a lot of
chaos,
flux and turmoil, I'm able to manage.
Was the culture of your home similarly calm?
Yes, I think it was quite calm. And, you know, a culture at home was talking about big things, talking about the state of the world, the state of India, the state of... What I meant is that we didn't get caught in small stuff.
In Bangalore?
In Bangalore, but later on what happened was my father had a mobile job. He had to keep changing locations. So at the age of 12, I went to stay with my uncle in a small town called Dharwad. And I was with him for 5 to 6 years, and then I went to IIT Bombay.
So how was it being away from your parents for 6 years when you were 12? Those are pretty formative
years.
Yeah,
sure. And I think in some sense, my uncle and his family were extremely generous and gracious. But definitely being on my own from the age of 12 certainly has contributed to my sense of independence.
On the subject of family, you met your wife, Rohini, in 1977 when you were still a student at the Indian Institute of Technology, Bombay. How did you meet?
Well, you know, I'd gone to her college and I was part of the IIT quiz team. And that's how I met her for the first time. And
IT quiz team, the information technology quiz.
No, it was
team.
A general quiz. You know, all these general, like, Jeopardy kind of thing. Oh. People ask random questions, which you answer. So I was on the IIT Bombay quiz team, and we went to take part in a quiz in Elphinstone College, where she was studying. That's how I bumped into her. And I think she's been very supportive because we got married the same year that Infosys was started in 1981. And when I told her that I'm going to quit my job and start a company, she was very supportive. And then again, when I quit Infosys in 2009, she was very supportive when I took up this massive job in the government.
You met Rohini at Indian Institute of Technology, Bombay. Can you talk to me about your time in college, where you were for 5 years?
It was probably one of the most formative experiences in my life because I came to this sort of elite campus and really got to know all my really good friends. A lot of them are from that those days. And it really helped me to develop my, not just my academic skills, but my social skills.
An example? Like, what were you like socially prior?
Well, you know, I stood for election and became the general secretary of the college. So all that really helped me to, I guess, become street smart, as they say. So when I got into business, I think the skills I learned there were very useful in being able to do business.
What were you like prior to IIT?
I think I was much more reticent and shy, and I don't think I had the same confidence that I had when I came out.
Just on the TV front, you watched TV for the first time when you were 17. What are some specifics about that experience?
Well, you know, this is one channel, black and white. So, you know, good thing about TV those days is you all watch the same program because there's only one program, and therefore it brought everybody together.
What do you watch these days?
Actually, I started watching a lot of U.S. Shows because you can just download them. You know,
it's like what?
Right now, I'm watching House of Cards on Netflix, and before that, we were watching West Wing, which I had not seen when it was done. Then we were watching Boss, which was a show and set in Chicago. Just catching up with U.S. television.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica.
My guest has been Nandan Nilekani. Coming up, we'll meet Dan Yates, co-founder of O-Power, a software company focused on energy efficiency. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dan Yates, co-founder of O-Power, a software company focused on energy efficiency. O-Power works with utilities to monitor how much energy a consumer uses and gives households and businesses incentives to lower their energy consumption. The idea is that through the use of behavioral science techniques such as peer pressure or peer proof, people will feel more compelled to act more responsibly, at least to keep up with their neighbors. Dan started O-Power in 2007 with his Harvard College classmate Alex Lasky. The company is based in Arlington, Virginia. Prior to starting O-Power, Dan launched EduSoft, a software company focused on public school assessments. EduSoft was sold for approximately $40 million to Houghton Mifflin in 2004. Dan is an avid hula hooper. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I heard you like giggle a little bit after hula hooper. Is that true?
I guess I'm a good hula hooper more than an avid hula hooper. It's become a running joke in the company after the first company picnic we had where there was a hula hoop contest that I nearly won but did not win.
Other than hula hooping at your company, can you describe what else you do at O-Power? How does O-Power work?
Well, is there anything else to do other than hula hoop?
You tell me.
Yeah, O-Power is a software company. We work with utilities to help them transform the way they deliver information to their consumers. People just don't really know enough about their energy use, and they're not motivated in the way they could be if they had the right information. And if we could just give them the right info, we could change energy behavior. And so what we do is we use behavioral science techniques, and in doing so, we've shown that we really can substantially reduce consumption consistently and persistently. And on average, we drive about a 2% savings, which for an individual, not much.
What is that, like $40 a year or so?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But for a utility, I mean, it's $160 million over our customer base per year.
And why are utilities caring to collaborate with you? Why do they have the incentive to decrease energy use? I know it has something to do with state-level compliance.
That's right.
But can you explain that further?
Legislatures have decided, hey, there's a better way. Let's roll, instead of, you know, to meet demand, let's pass a standard that asks our utilities to run programs to help people save energy. And so then the utility puts forward a portfolio of programs, things like light bulb subsidies and O-Power. And then what happens is they put a small tax on the bill. And the only programs they run are ones that actually save you more money than they cost. So the tax is always less than your savings. So the key thing is that utilities, with that tax, they get to recover any of the revenue they would have lost. So they're still made whole. So that way everybody wins.
We're talking about incentives based on behavioral science techniques. What incentives are most powerful for people to reduce their consumption?
The most well-known of the techniques that we employ is the neighbor comparison. It's how we started. So the first product we brought to market was actually a mailed paper report, and we chose the mail because utilities don't have enough customer email addresses. It shows people how their energy use compares to their neighbors and then gives them targeted recommendations on how to save. But the peer proof is a very powerful tool, but it's one of many. Mm-hmm. So as an example, commitment is another very powerful behavioral science technique. Typically, customers who set a goal to save energy save over 8% a year. A third example is just rapid feedback.
You see a lot of this dynamic in other areas such as exercise, right? You give people instant feedback. They're setting their goals. There's the social pressure.
Absolutely.
Where else do you see this happening?
Well, I think there's a whole trend now of the measured self. All of these different wristwatches that track your heartbeat and change, how many steps you've taken, they're not doing anything to you other than giving you feedback. But what we measure is what we modify. So the behavioral science is more of a tool to grab the customer and engage them about themselves.
How are you using science behavioral techniques in your personal life? For example, you have a baby, you're married. Do you see yourself constantly applying these techniques in other ways personally?
I've been accused anxiously in business cases situations of being an expert negotiator because people fear that I have some mastery of the behavioral science sphere that I must admit I don't think I have. Mm. But yeah, you can't help but think about these techniques.
In addition to the behavioral science component of the company, you also have a pretty robust data analytics feature. Can you describe that some more?
We can help people understand their usage in very easy, timely, and important to act on ways. As a simple example, we do a predictive high bill forecast. So we've all had that experience where you get that bill in the mail in the middle of winter, and it's $500 or $300, and it blows you away. Now, you get a call from us, like a fraud alert. Mm-hmm. Hey, we're 12 days into the month. You look like you're on track for a $300 bill. And what a relief, especially for a low-income customer.
They receive phone calls?
That's right, we do.
Are you the voice for these calls? Because you have that voice, or you're impersonating that voice quite well.
You have received a high bill. No. It's not me.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dan Yates, co-founder of O-Power and an energy efficiency company that partners with utility companies to reduce energy consumption. The utility companies pay O-Power for its software and receives payments from the government as an incentive to encourage energy reduction. Now, when you first thought of founding this company, did you have this behavioral science in mind, or is it something that you arrived at after coming up with the idea?
Actually, the behavioral science component was one of the original pieces.
And you have a chief scientist. His name is Robert Cialdini. He's a social psychologist. How integral was he in the founding of the company?
Yeah, so the way we got started was we had a simple idea that there were a billion utility bills going out a year to Americans, and there was this huge missed opportunity to educate people about their energy use. But that was, and we knew there was energy efficiency funding out there, but it wasn't enough to start a business. And then we got lucky, and this is where the serendipity came in. We were introduced to the research of Robert Cialdini, who had just the year prior concluded a study with the Hewlett Foundation in San Francisco, or Palo Alto, rather, that showed conclusively that if you gave people information about their energy use relative to the average of similar-sized homes in the area, that they would reduce their consumption.
How were you introduced to him? By whom?
I was talking about, there's a lot of people, and I was waving my utility bill around at breakfast with this woman, Rhea Sue, who's the Hewlett Foundation, and her eyes went wide, and she said, you won't believe this. We literally just got a research report on this very fact, you know, 2 weeks ago. And she scanned and sent me the studies. And then we reached out to Bob, and it's been, you know, that's the beginning of the story.
Could you explain the study that he did with the fans?
The study was to try and convince convince residential homeowners to make a simple, low-cost efficiency move of turning off their air conditioner and switching to a fan in the evening. And they did a door hanger campaign. And they put a door hanger on each door with four different messages. The first message simply said, it was a monetary message, you can save $50 every month if you do this. Second message was about the environment, you can help keep the skies clean for California if you do this. Third message was about preserving resources for the future and being a good citizen. And then they measured those first three against a control group, which received no message. And they saw no impact in consumption, as if they hadn't come. And this is, again, an expensive way to go about marketing. So they had a fourth group that got a message that simply said, in a recent survey of your neighbors, three-quarters of them say they turn off their AC and switch to a fan in the evening. Join your neighbors. With no justification for what the personal benefit was, the economic benefit, the environmental benefit, none of that. Just do what the rest of the folks are doing. And that group saw a 6% reduction in consumption.
Why were you and Alex focused on doing something in the energy arena? You had started a company in education, for example.
So I started an educational software company called EduSoft, and we sold the company, and I had the opportunity to take some time off. And I talked my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, into taking a year-long trip with me. We bought a Toyota 4Runner, we shipped it up to Alaska, and we drove the full Pan American Highway from tip to tip.
So from the Arctic Sea to Patagonia?
That's right.
How did you meet Toby?
We met at a wedding in Birmingham, Alabama.
So here you are on a road trip in Latin America, and what connective tissue is there to O-Power?
So we took this trip. Among other things, we were listening to books on iPod, and we had downloaded Jared Diamond's Collapse, which is really the story of human populations throughout time that have had ecological collapse, ranging from the Mayans to the inhabitants of Easter Island, and you know, how through leadership collapse can be averted, and without it, you can have true catastrophic, you know, ecological degradation. And as we were driving the drive, it felt like I was watching the movie in real time accompanying this book.
What are examples of that?
When we were driving through Guatemala, we were driving across this large plain with cows and bucolic scene. And then we arrived at this outcropping of rock. And on top of this rock, probably a couple acres worth, was the densest rainforest you could think of. And it hit both of us. This huge plain we were driving through had historically been a rainforest. But when you see those things and you see how stark it is and you realize how much we have changed the earth, that's when it hits you.
Toby Whitman, you're now wife. You were still boyfriend and girlfriend on your Latin American trip. What is something surprising that she learned about you on that trip or not on that trip?
She thought I was going to propose when we got to the southern tip, and she hadn't talked to me about that expectation, and so I didn't do that, and that was a shocker. So I made it up to her. What I explained was that I felt odd proposing to her after being a year away from friends and family and feeling disconnected from them, which was just how I felt. I felt like in many ways proposing was more of a public thing than a private thing because I knew I wanted to marry her. Mm-hmm. So to make it up, I went and videoed all of her friends and our families telling them that I was going to propose to her and asking them what they thought. And then I proposed by showing her this video of basically everyone else knowing before she knew, which was a lot of fun.
So here you are. You and Alex are starting O-Power. You both don't have a background in the energy industry. What were the first things that you did?
As we were just starting this, we were talking to some folks in Texas who told us that we just had to get down there and get involved with what was going on the legislative side. And there was a bill being introduced around energy efficiency. And we flew out with not even yet incorporated, but with a blow-up, you know, mock-up of our energy report, 2-foot by 3-foot foam core blow-up, marched around with no company, with no brand name, with not even business cards. We managed to meet with all of the key legislators, and we got legislation written into this bill that authorized the utilities to use this public efficiency funding for home energy reports. Now, never mind, there were a few dyes that we didn't dot and T's we didn't cross, and we weren't able to use that funding for years to come. But for us, it was this amazing realization that if we could move the needle that far with so little, that there was a real appetite for this.
Yeah, it was incredibly self-actualizing.
Yes. So then we said, okay, let's do this. And that's when we got serious. We raised some money, we incorporated the company, and we went out to, and we hired some people, and we went out to go sell utilities.
Do you have a story or an anecdote about your early meetings with some of these utilities?
Well, our first utility that we sold was the City of Sacramento SMUD, the Sacramento Municipal Utility District. Allie Crawford, who was a program manager, had funding for a carbon calculator, which was tools to enter in the different parts of your energy use throughout your life and calculate your total carbon footprint. And we showed her what we were doing, and she just was fascinated by it and thought, if you can do my calculator and this, we can work together. And so we went back and in a 10-day period worked nights and weekends and built a carbon calculator.
Were there other utilities or other recollections of meetings with utilities who were not as amenable to what you were doing?
No, I mean, you can't succeed without hearing no 100 times.
Right. So what are examples of some of those?
Most of those are customers of ours now, so I don't have any great examples I want to share.
We talk about getting funding in the early days, and NEA in D.C. was one of your earliest investors, and there's a story of Harry Weller, I think he's a partner at NEA, hearing what you were doing, and he said, utilities give you data and they're paying you? How do we invest?
Yeah, so Harry had a very clear vision, which took me a long time to fully appreciate, that the real power in our business was that we were being put in a position with all the utilities' energy data to be able to help them on a whole host of consumer-facing issues they had. And that the fact that they were entrusting us with their data put us in a phenomenally strategic place in the landscape. And then that they were paying us for that as opposed to us begging them for it was even more astonishing.
I want to talk about your upbringing, your early life. You grew up in San Diego. Your dad was in the Air Force.
Yeah.
And your mom was a Hebrew school teacher.
That's right.
What did your dad do in the Air Force?
He was a pilot. He was an instructor pilot with a T-33 jet, and then turboprop. And then he flew C-130s for 10 years, which are those huge cargo planes.
Was he ever in action?
He was. He was in Vietnam. He flew air support in Zaire back when we thought that Mobutu was a good guy to back up, which is, you know, not his proudest day, but he was a good airman. After my dad left the military, he went into defense contracting. He worked for a couple different firms. We ended up moving to San Diego where he worked at General Dynamics.
We always like to put a bow around like how our childhood influenced what we're doing now. But like what are certain elements of your youth that feature prominently for you?
Yeah, I think for me, if I can draw a line back from O-Power to my youth, it's conservation and computer science. I took a class in 11th grade in AP Pascal and loved it.
AP Pascal being a programming language.
Exactly right. It felt like you were bringing the computer to life. To be clear, I was not a hacker who spent their nights and weekends writing code all the time. But I said this is what I want to do. It's what I want to study in college, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the other thing for me is I grew up in a family where we would reuse plastic bags and we always turned out the lights and we barely ran the heat and these kinds of things. It established deeply ingrained in me an aesthetic that we shouldn't be wasteful. And my mom grew up in Israel in the 50s, they had nothing, you know. And my dad grew up very poor, so I grew up with parents who had their upbringing in a totally different time and era where they were extremely conservative with things.
After college, you worked at a music startup called Echo Networks.
That's right.
From there, you then started EduSoft, which is this company focused on the public school assessments area. And Jake Himmelman was your co-founder at EduSoft, and you had known him from Harvard as well.
That's right.
What is he doing now?
Jake Himmelman has started a network of private, very, very low-cost schools in Kenya. He has, I believe, over 50,000 students now in his schools. And the schools cost less than the public schools. and they have perfect teacher attendance, and they have significantly higher student scores. And he's scaling this now across Africa.
And incidentally, you were raising money for EduSoft in 2000. So even though the story ends well, you had kind of a tumultuous beginning, at least raising money, is my assumption.
It was brutal.
I heard a story that you, when potential investors would visit, you would fill your desks in the office to make it seem like you were busier than you were. Is that
right.
True?
So we had...
Whose idea was that?
It was Jay's, of course. Jay was a magician as a kid. And a vacuum cleaner salesman, and so he had all the great tricks. It was actually the first time Houghton Mifflin came to our offices. We wanted to appear bigger, and we told our friends we would buy them coffee and lunch if they would come and work out of desks in our office from 10 a.m. to noon.
Mm.
And we put phones on the desk and made it all look like we had 12 people at the company when there was only four of us. The problem was... 2 months later, the same guy came back, and we were like, what are we going to do? We got to get the same friends in.
So don't be fooled if you enter the office of O-Power. Some might be paid actors.
I can affirm we have no paid actors.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Dan Yates, co-founder of O-Power. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.